Take some down, pass them around, take a couple pins, bring them back there. Oh, yeah, hey.
So we're filling out sign-in sheets and raffle prize, raffle drawing forms. Must be present to win.
I'm going to kill the iPod if you don't mind.
There you go.
Thank you.
I don't think I have any more. There's no more audio on that, so we won't ever use that again.
Are there any more forms?
There's some on the other side, it looks like.
Where?
Oh, on the floor there? Or on the stage floor? And if you want, you can move closer, because we're not going to do much more projection stuff.
Closer, and I didn't.
What do you promise?
To print and bring forms.
Video projection. Why don't we start?
Yeah, let's get started. Okay, so welcome back.
Our youngest member.
Youngest member? Oh, look at that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
All right, hey, Mary.
Good high frequency response.
I would say that she could be an honorary member, but we all have a different understanding now of what that means. And since it's just us here, I can tell you that when I wrote up that nomination, I wrote the nomination for him, I swear to God that I thought that it was going to give him a free membership. And I thought, geez, this is a big hassle to go through to get him a free membership. We should just do a collection and get him a membership that way.
That's all you wanted, Dan, was just a free membership?
I thought that's what it was.
That would have been a lot easier.
And
Dan,
are you saying you want a free membership?
No, well, yeah, but
Well, you have to have Frank Lifford's career. That's what you have to do. You're close, JJ.
Well,
I mean,
but it's
no
a much
slacker,
bigger deal, obviously, than a free member.
I think at 65, you can also apply as a life member. But you have to have been a member for something like 20 years.
Yeah, we qualify.
It's easier just to pay your dues every month.
Yeah.
Or year or whatever it is.
Every 5 years.
Okay, so in case anybody missed out, we have little slips that you can fill out if you want to be part of the Dora Prize later.
While they last.
And
let's do our walk around.
Let's do our ring around the room. So let's everybody just kind of introduce yourself, a couple sentences about who you are and what your relationship is to audio. And, I guess you're kind of spread out, but
we have good acoustics.
Why don't you guys
just
project?
Speak up.
Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Yes, why don't you start, Steve?
Yeah, let's go from back to front. Start with the least.
Hello, guys.
And what are you?
What am I? I'm human from the third planet. I'm a mastering engineer and a circuit board designer, and I'm currently writing a book on desktop mastering right now for Hal Leonard. And I just got voted in as the governor of the Recording Academy, Board of Governors locally. So that happened.
Woohoo.
And we're bringing the Wrecking Crew to town, which Rick will be talking about in a little bit.
Rich, Lunchbox Audio, I do recording and retail.
And I'm nominating him for the committee.
Very cool. All right. We'll talk about that in a minute. Yeah.
I'm Doug Heyman, musician and sometimes audio recording at home. Very low key, amateur stuff.
Cool. Should we jump to the back real quick?
I'm Joey Marguerite. I'm a vocalist, singer, recording artist, and jazz, pop jazz, soul jazz, and my experience in audio engineering, radio announcer, and production and songwriting.
Cool. Welcome. Sound guy. You're one of us.
Hi, I'm TJ. I'm the audio engineer for this theater, and I have been doing live sound in and around Seattle for the last 6 years.
Very cool. Welcome.
I'm John Mayer. I do sound somewhat for the City Church, which is all over this area. Also for Fishnet Theater, the Traveling Christian Theater Group, and I just started interning for Mike Theater.
All right.
Mike Pateski, Vocal Sport Studios, committee member, cellist, and probably in this group.
Travis Sable, composer, audio engineer. I do indie video games right now and working my way to where it is.
All right. Yay.
I'm Ivan Tashin, working at Microsoft Research and Open Process Technologies, member of the committee.
Excellent.
I'm Mary Marins, and I work in healthcare at Philippi for a doctor. The reason I'm here is I love music.
All right.
I'm Scott Marins. I work at Motorola, and I'll be talking about some of the stuff I do in June. Some things to be determined, date, and some topics, but basically, multimedia effects and some acoustic echo cancellation, that kind of stuff. And this is Micah Linnea, and she is just a baby right now.
There you go. That's where the acoustic echo cancellation comes in handy. Let's see, come down to the...
I'm Steve Stusser. I'm a musician, a friend of Rick Chin's, and I'm a home studio enthusiast.
Excellent. Should we just go back and forth?
Lou Covenets, I'm a live broadcast video engineer, do major, broadcast baseball games, things like that. When I'm not doing that, I do record sound for documentaries and news magazine shows, which reminds me, someone suggested, I got a broken set of Sony 7506 headphones. I need a part to either cannibalize for another pair of headsets or...
You can get them from Sony.
Yeah, it costs $30.
Well, that's Sony.
Which part?
The
plastic
that attached the headband to the...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I got a broken one of those, too.
Next. Duct tape, hot glue.
Who's next?
My name is Chris Deckard. I'm an electrical engineer, and I got my hands in our two many things, but by day I'm working on industrial robots, and I learned the other day that 24 volts is a signal. And it went, the noise field was induced with 36 volts of noise on the line. So, well, these motors, they chop, they take 500 volts DC and they chop it at 4 kilohertz to make AC, or, three phase AC. So, it's a much different environment.
Jim Johnston, soon to be former chief scientist at DTS.
What?
Mark Edman, I call myself IO Jewel. I design and build high performance speaker systems that live to play recordings like Frank
Steve Wilkins, sometimes musician, home recording enthusiast, and liberal arts major.
Greg Mauser, AES committee member, musician, software engineer by day, and I constantly, obsessively mess around with tube amps and guitar pickups.
Dave Francois, I am treasurer of the Pacific Northwest section, technical support engineer by day, trombonist, and live sound guy.
Hi, I'm Rick Smartiasi. I run a small company, sound company called Integrated Light and Sound. We do lighting, sound and video, and entertainment rigging. I also work over at Seattle Center as a sound and video technician.
I'm Bill Levy. I do location recording. I have a company via audio, a lot of choral groups, classical music, some radio broadcasts for King FM, that kind of thing.
Cool. I'm Steve Willott. I'm on the committee. I teach at Shoreline Community College, the audio engineering program there. And I'm so flabbergasted by this presentation for Frank, and I'm completely blown away by it. So, very awesome.
Yeah, nice job, Dan and Bob, on the medley. That was great.
Bob had to leave, but he appreciates that. Is that it?
Well,
just
who
us.
Are you? Yeah.
Oh, no, you know who I am. I was in, my bio was in the thing. So. TJ, I lied. We're going to play a little bit of music here. So you tell me when.
Okay, well, we're going to do announcements now. And the first announcement is that we are with the, who are we doing this with? Is it RAAA or?
No, the Recording Academy.
The Recording Academy?
Yeah.
Well, I won't say what we're doing.
People,
you're talking about it, Rick.
Yeah,
let me talk.
Okay, so on May 6th, we have a, go ahead and run and roll. See you there. What? TJ, if you can pull that down so I can talk over it. So, we're doing a screening of a film called The Wrecking Crew, and it's a documentary about a group of studio musicians from the 60s and the 70s and into the 80s. There was, I lost count of how many of them, but they played on, this is the audio resume for one of the members, Al Blaine, who's a drummer, and the guy has played on literally everything. And he'll play literally anything, including ashtrays. And I've seen him play his corduroy pants with a matchbook. And one day somebody asked him for some percussion, hand percussion, and he pulled out a couple of film cans that had rice in them. And he was shaking them. Anyway, so as you can hear, the hits just keep coming. And that's what these guys did. And so the film is a documentary about them. They're kind of the unsung heroes. I mean, who knew that they played on most of the early Beach Boys stuff? It wasn't the Beach Boys. It was these guys. Anyway.
And there's a special deal for AS members?
No special deal. It's at EMP. It's a $15 suggested donation. You're free to donate more. You need to call the number that's on the website, on our website, and it'll give you all the info you want, or you can pick up one of these cards in the lobby. Let's see, about the donation. The deal is that the filmmakers need money in order to get performance rights to allow the music that they used in the film be played to the public. So right now they're skirting that issue by doing this as a benefit for their own film, and it's not open to the general public, so to speak. So it's not like it's a theatrical release. But they need like $300,000 to get all the rights. So your contribution will help further that. All the money goes to them. EMP's donating the space. We're just helping to plug it. The Recording Academy is also doing this. You have to RSVP, so make sure if this is of interest, you go get the card or go to our website and look.
Okay. Thank you, Steve Turnage, for organizing this.
It's worth it.
Yeah, it's really cool.
Hey, Rick, can you give me that number? Because I registered, but I haven't called yet.
206-834-1000.
Okay. Let's see, next announcement. Elections. Some of us are officers and committee members of the local section. These are elected positions. We have elections every June. We are required by our bylaws to announce the elections ahead of time, so that's what we're doing right now. If you'd like to be a member of the committee or an officer, my condolences, but you're welcome. contact me, the chair, and how do you contact me?
There's contact information on the website. Each of us.
Or you send a smoke signal in the general direction of Vashon Island.
Yeah, just come to Vashon and look for me. I'm usually hanging out at the espresso stands. But we do take floor nominations, so no worries if you didn't get that together before the election. You can nominate yourself 5 minutes before we vote. But the general process is that we have a nominations committee who's been out twisting arms trying to get enough people to fill the open seats. And I think we're just about to that point now. And again, we will invite further nominations from the floor at the June meeting. There's your warning. Anything else I should add to that? No? The final announcement is next month, May, we will have a meeting. We don't yet know what that meeting will be. We've got a couple interesting leads. One is the guy who invented the electret microphone, who's apparently going to be in town. And if JJ can kidnap him and haul him off somewhere and let us know quickly enough, we'll hopefully do that.
That would be the third week of June. Or not June, third week of May.
It would probably be right after ASA.
Okay.
Okay. So that, I mean, if you can make it happen, that would be very cool.
So this is, the reason he's coming to town is that the Acoustical Society of America, which is what is to acoustics what we are to audio, they're having one of their bi-yearly conventions, or they call it a meeting, in Seattle. And it's the week of May 22nd.
That's nice, but let's talk about PA here. Let's
okay.
Get to it.
Okay. Enough of the announcements. Thank you, Dan. So, I'm sure some of you have found yourself in the position of being in your whatever church, school, theater, community, like myself. Somebody realizes you know a little bit about audio and they decide that you should be the guy running the PA system at the auction or event at the church or whatever. And maybe like me, you don't know what the hell you're doing. I know the guts in the boxes, but I don't know how to operate them. And I have great admiration for the guys who know how to run those boxes. So I've been asking a lot of annoying questions to Dan and Rick lately because I got kind of roped into helping out at a theater on Vashon Island and thought, well, maybe other people have some of these same questions. Some of them open up some really interesting discussions about loudness and mixing and acoustics and so on. So I'm very thankful to Rick and Dan tonight that they're willing to indulge in this different type of event. We're going to just kind of have a general open discussion about issues in running PA systems, and everybody's invited to fire questions at these guys. We only have so much time. Just as a warning, I have to catch a certain ferry, which means I'm going to turn into a pumpkin at 10:45, whether
we'll
we're done or not. I guess without further ado, we can just launch into
question.
It. So I'll just lead off with saying that Ian Moore, who was a presenter at one of our meetings earlier this year, played a show on Vashon Island last weekend in a small bar, a very small stage, and was complaining after the show to me that he could not hear himself, despite the fact that I heard or that I measured on my SPL meter that they were doing 100 dB SPL in the room. And he still couldn't hear himself sing, and he was trying to harmonize with other guys and was very frustrated. He was actually really pissed off. And I was trying to figure out, how in the hell can you have 100 dB SPL in the room and not be able to hear yourself? And maybe I'll pose that one to you. I mean, what was going wrong there during that event?
Well, first I want to ask you what the PA was and what the monitors were and what type of music it was and what was the sound level coming from. It was a band?
It was a five-piece rock band, just heavy rock, lots of guitar happened, lots of bass.
So a lot of stage sound.
A lot, yeah, it was all coming off the stage, really. The only thing the PA was the vocals. The PA was a pair of Mackie 450s.
Uh-huh.
And it was fighting against all the stuff, a whole bunch of big monitors and amp racks and, you know, all that was coming off the stage.
Whose monitors?
I didn't look.
Well, I mean, was it the band?
Oh, it was the band's monitors, yes.
So they brought their own monitors, not their own PA.
They just didn't bring the front of house system.
Right. They plugged in the snake, and then the rest was the clubs. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where was their sound man?
He was in the back against the wall.
Was there communication going on throughout the evening of Turn Me Up?
No.
Or me and the monitor.
There was a little bit of that in the beginning of the show, but they, I think, just sort of gave up. And they just played. And they actually pulled it off. They sounded reasonable for us.
Was there feedback throughout the show?
A little bit here and there. Not a lot.
Not a lot.
But a little bit, yeah.
So there's several possibilities. The first is that the stage sound was too loud and overwhelming the monitors, which were not capable of getting loud enough. The second is that it was so loud in the room. What was the room like? Was it reflective or absorptive?
So this club is kind of cool in that one entire wall is a giant garage door that opens up in the summer, you know, so it's kind of almost an outdoor type feel. But when it's closed, it's just a big sheet metal door with glass. And that's the
behind
back
him?
Wall of the stage.
Mm.
And then just two parallel, you know, sheetrock walls, just a rectangle.
This is a bar?
The bar.
So everything coming out of the monitors is going and hitting the wall and coming back.
It's bouncing off of metal.
And everything
glass.
Out of the drums is going back and hitting.
The drummer was right against
all
the
of
metal
the,
wall.
All of the guitar amps are going back and hitting, and the sidewalls are hard, too.
Sidewalls are hard.
Yeah, well, it's a tough situation.
Yeah. So as a sound guy, what do you do? You know, the band's got all their amps turned up. You walk up on stage and turn the amps down, or...
You do that at a moment in between songs, saying if you want to be able to hear yourself, you need to turn your amps down. There's only so much I can do. I don't know what the monitors were and how capable they were. If they were the band's monitors, presumably they've worked for them in other situations.
Yeah, I think they were borrowed monitors, not the normal ones.
Well,
take your chances.
Yeah, we don't know that.
Usually the reason for the season.
Yeah, I asked if there was a lot of feedback happening, because if it was a lot of feedback, that would indicate that they were coming up. If there was not, that they were very present and getting back into the microphone and causing feedback. If it wasn't a lot of feedback, then it's possible they could not have been on at all. Or there could have not. Maybe they just put all instruments in the monitors. I don't know. I wasn't there. But certainly all of the things that you named are not conducive to a happy experience.
Yeah, well, it's sort of a loaded question.
Yeah, it's a tough situation. You just do the best you can as a person in my position.
Right.
And I was in a situation like that one time where I was in a concrete, linoleum, and glass room about this big with a band that turned out to be an AC/DC cover band. And I mic'd everything up beforehand because I didn't know what was going on or going to happen because I didn't work with these people before. And then it was just way too loud. I didn't need the drums and the guitars and the PA, so I had it. All I had in the PA was monitors. All I had in the PA was vocals. You know, there's nothing you can do. It's terrible.
Yeah.
You have enough PA to get some sound out there, and whether or not a single pair of Mackie 450s was enough, I don't know. But you got to have the horsepower there, and then you've got to have the horsepower and the monitors coming back at you. And in an ideal world, it comes to their ear and it doesn't come back at them from some other place. So
what scares me is they've already set the baseline loudness on stage at 100, and now I have to compete with that in the PA. So now we're looking at, 105 dB SPL.
Right. And what they're playing out there is going into this vocal mic and coming out the PA as well. And that's the other thing, is you can pick a vocal mic if you have enough stuff in your arsenal that is not a fat pattern microphone, assuming that the person is not going to get off to the side. If they can stay right on it, then you can get away with a pretty tiny pattern, as opposed to a pattern that's going to pick up the whole world around them, so that what's coming out of the PA and what's coming out of the monitors is more just what's in front of the microphone rather than what's everywhere. And that's one strategy.
Right.
That doesn't work for people who move around while they're singing and do stuff like that. It just does not work. But for somebody who sits on it like this and moves around and goes like that and stays relatively constant, it works okay.
Are there tricks you can play with EQ? Sort of carve out a spot for the vocals? And
that's a theory that people use, and I've never had much luck at that. I'm not that smart. So yes, you want to, in theory, and I'll stop talking so Rick can talk, but there's a school of mixing where you notch out things for other things to fit in. So you take the bass out of the vocal so the bass guitar and bass drum can work together. You take out low mids of something so something else can be emphasized. You emphasize the low mids of the guitar or whatever, and there's you can read about those things where you fit everything into a pocket so that if you listen to it by itself, it sounds terrible because it's all this, I guess this is the frequency response. So the frequency response is all jagged, but when you add these other things in, it all fits together. But I'm not smart enough to do that, and I don't work with people often enough to know who sounds better where. And I often do things where people take lengthy solos or everybody leaves the stage and the star is there singing. And if you have the frequency response like that on the star, that's the only thing you hear. It's pretty weird.
Mm-hmm. Rick?
Yeah, I've heard people talk about doing that in the studio. And I think in the studio it makes complete sense because you have control over all the elements. You know, you turn off the you turn off the studio monitors and it gets quiet, right? But you can't do that live because you've got all the stage sound and that's part of what the audience is hearing and you're adding to that. So how can you carve out a hole in the spectrum to make room for something if what you're doing in the PA isn't the dominant thing? Mm-hmm. Now, if it's a huge band in a large room, like let's say like the Eagles playing in the Seattle Center Coliseum, then yeah, you can probably do a little more of that. But in a bar, no, I don't think so.
Yeah, and that's what you mentioned there about the studio being about control is very important to differentiate that from live sound because it's out of control. And as the person behind the wheel back there, behind the console, you're doing your best to tame uncontrollable things that you have no control over. You have no control over the room. You have no control over how loud they're playing on stage. There's a variety of things that you have little control over. So when you're mixing, a lot of the time you're filling in holes. So if the drums are pounding loud enough, you don't run that through the PA. You bring stuff up to match the loudest source from the stage. You bring everything else up. We were talking earlier about a board mix, making a recording of a board mix, and how that's often not at all representative of what it should sound like if you were doing a studio mix because the board is filling in things that aren't already out at your ear. And so if the drums are killing pounding, you're not going to hear the drums through the board mix because if you're doing what you should be doing, you're not making something that's already too loud louder.
My experience that the drummer really sets the level.
Yes, the drummer really sets the level. Absolutely. We're going to repeat questions since we don't have things here.
Okay.
Yeah.
So have you ever used barricades, the plexiglass?
Yeah, I have some of those.
Is that effective?
It is, but it's a giant pain in the neck to do.
Most drummers don't like those things.
Yeah, they don't like being behind them. There's some that are used to it and understanding of why it has to be. And if they're on the payroll of the person who's up front here, then they're going to have that plexiglass whether they like it or not. But if you're bringing plexiglass as the sound person and say, hey, I want you to be behind this because it's going to be better out here, they're going to...
So when you have something like that, what does it do to the drum sound within the enclosure? I mean, how much does it affect what you're picking up in the mics?
There is a sound in the enclosure, but you're close miking the drums. So That's not what it's what's going into it.
Okay.
I mean, you, obviously, the overheads are there, but you're notching out, or you're high-passing the overheads usually.
I don't.
Don't you?
No. For me,
if you're,
but the kind of music that I do,
yeah.
which is not rock and roll,
yeah.
My drum sound starts with the overheads,
mm-hmm.
and then I'm filling in, but I want all the air that's above them,
yeah.
which, of course, for leakage, is just it's horrible.
Yeah.
So you have to have everybody's cooperation.
So more on loudness, the show that I saw in Vashon was about 100 dB SPL, and it was loud. It hurt badly. I was really regretting not having
it. What scale?
C? Well, first of all, my iPhone SPL meter, so I'm not sure how accurate that is. But
probably C.
That was C-weighted,
yeah.
fast on the little meter. Mm-hmm. And it was loud. It was super loud. I went to the show the next night in Ballard at a club about the same size, and it sounded great. And I'm sure it was just as loud, but it wasn't as harsh. And I was trying to figure out what was
same
different.
Band.
Same band, yeah.
Oh, really?
Together. Yeah.
You just point out you're talking about the sound intensity. Loudness is your perceived level. Now, when it sounds harsh, if you've got a flatter spectrum, it's going to sound louder for the same amount of sound pressure. So you got to remember, loudness is perceived intensity. It's sensation level. Sorry to be a pedant.
No, that, actually, I was going to ask you your feedback on this.
So you can make a sound that's 100 dB that sounds like it's 80, or a sound that's 100 dB that sounds like it's 100 in terms of sensation level. And if it measured the same level, but it sounded a lot better and it wasn't as harsh, you probably didn't have as much high frequency spread. There was some distortion or some resonance in the room or something or peaking high frequencies, which will pick the loudness back.
And there's an importance of understanding what 100 dB means to know what type of music we're talking about. So you can make a reggae show or a reggae band that has just pounding low end and gives you a real nice enveloping feeling. The subs and the mids are way out of proportion. So when you look at that meter, it's 100 dB, but it's measuring, well, on you, to your end, to your view, the low frequencies. And there's not so much high frequencies. If I put 100 dB of full range, just like JJ says, you want to just plug your ears.
Well, the thing is, the very low frequencies are not proportionally as loud.
Mm-hmm. Right. And you can tell that by taking your meter, which actually does have an A and a C switch on it, and going back and forth. And if it's reading 100 dB A and 100 dB C, that's a very different perception than 100 dB C and 80 dB A, because that tells you how much of the low frequency is tipped, because the C is measuring that low frequency and the A is rolling it off and ignoring it.
Mm-hmm. So this might be a controversial question, but I mean, what are the appropriate loudnesses for different types of, I mean, there's spoken word events like this,
mm-hmm.
there's theater type events, plays, and so on. There's rock and roll. Just, is there a rule of thumb? You know, 100 seemed quite loud to me.
Yeah, it's what works for that type of music.
What
That's
works?
The rule of thumb.
If the crowd's
that type
happy,
of
then
content.
It's good.
100 dB of spoken word would be
Ouch.
Unpleasant for me.
Yeah.
100 dB of heavy metal, you'd be fired because you're not turning it up loud enough.
Mm-hmm.
Which would be happy for me. I'd be happy to be fired for that, from that gig. And have.
So, I mean, are there safety issues, JJ? Like,
well, once you get above 90 dB SPL, you're starting to get into the range where hearing damage starts to happen very quickly, except very low frequencies. That's all I can say. I don't like to talk about it because there's all sorts of litigation and people
yeah.
going this way and that way.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, my answer is over 90 dB, you're going to hurt your hearing. That's my answer.
Mm-hmm.
The OSHA 85 dB, 8-hour exposure level, assumes that you'll have 5% hearing loss after 20 years.
Hmm.
Did you say 85?
85.
I thought it was 95.
At 85.
No, 95 is high. Well, what scale again?
Is this 95A slow.
A, yeah.
A slow.
Yeah.
80, but if, even at 85, we will have hearing loss over 20 years.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know.
Yeah, for me.
Your hair cells, it's the only ones you get.
For me personally, over 90A is unpleasant, and I don't care for it. And I'll wear my earphones, my Sony headphones with the plug in my pocket, because I need to be looking like I'm working.
Many years ago when I did live, I had a set of wireless blue headphones that said NSA on.
Yeah. Mind safety appliance.
Yes.
Yeah.
Is that headphone effective for your hearing protection to do that?
It's better than nothing.
Are earplugs better?
Yes. But if you're the one mixing the show, you gotta not look like you're hating being there.
Right.
By putting the earplugs, the yellow earplugs in your ear. And I've tried mixing with, I've got some of the, the musicians' ones that, the blue foam or the red, yellow foam ones. From your perspective, let the lows through, and as you get up into the highs, the frequency response goes down. And these musicians, one, let things through evenly, but lower it by whatever insert you've got, 10, 15, 20 dB. And I've tried mixing with those things in, and I want to turn it up louder. I find that when I take them out and put them back in, I want to turn it up more, and so I don't mix like that so much.
I'm suspicious anytime I walk past the front of house console and I see that the sound guy's got earplugs in.
Yeah.
It's a clue to me that I don't want to be there.
Yeah.
Well,
but
if you reduce the level, when you get above 80 dB, the filters in your ear actually start to broaden because you're getting overloaded. So actually, if you drop the level below 80 dB at your ear across the spectrum, you actually can mix better because you can actually distinguish what's going on better.
I agree.
That's the same thing, you know, if you're a rock
concert. 80 is pretty low, but
yeah,
I agree with the concept.
You stick your fingers in your ears, well, that's when you start to see the filters spread. By the time you get to 95, they spread a lot. So it's a question of where you just, but you see the start of the spread at 80. Mm-hmm. And, but you ever notice that when you're in a concert, you stick your fingers in your ears, you can understand the person next to you better?
Yeah, and I was just going to say, I found that when I have the foam earplugs in my ears, the acoustics of the room disappear. The terrible reflections go away. I did some shows in Union Station for a while, if you were downtown ever in that horrible place, with about a 25-second reverb time. And it made it better. You lose all of the reflections, which are lower in volume, and you just hear the direct sound out of the PA. Is that a...
Well, what's happening is you're actually able to distinguish the direct sound better.
Yeah.
Not actually losing them, but what happens, because you're still at the point where the loudness adaptation has happened. What happens when you get above 80 or 85, the loudness adaptation starts to... The thing that scales loudness to intensity starts to break because it's overloaded.
Hmm.
So what happens if you get back down below that level, you know what the precedence effect is, law of the first wavefront? That starts to work again. But at very high levels, continuous very high levels, when all the outer hair cells are depolarized, it does not work.
Mm.
So what happens is you're actually getting your spatial hearing ability back.
Mm.
You notice when it's really loud, you have a lot of trouble distinguishing direction?
Yes.
That's why.
Mm.
You don't have the ability.
It's just a mush.
Yeah, that's why. You don't have the ability to actually detect the leading edges of wavefront.
You guys are getting a lot for your money here.
I just gave 6 lectures on this 2 weeks ago.
Cool. Any other questions or comments on loudness?
So when you do a sound check, it's an empty room, and then you have a capacity crowd, it's maybe too generalized a question, but what kinds of compensation do you find you have to do on the fly after the room's full?
You mix the monitors and get the musicians comfortable and be sure that you have signal going into your PA and that your PA is working appropriately. and don't screw with it beyond that. Because as you say, it's going to change drastically. And some places will change a little bit, and some places will change a huge amount. So if you're in a place where it's, well, I just use a rule of thumb that I don't do a lot of house EQ, except as there's feedback issues during the sound check. And then once the audience comes in is when you start paying attention to those kind of fine points. You get a starting place, and you get them happy on stage, and then you deal with what has changed, because you can't predict it. And if you drastically cut stuff during the sound check in the house, if it's not a feedback issue, if you're doing a tonal thing, you're just wasting your time, I think.
Yeah. I mean, when I'm running my large system, I really do no EQ. I balance the system using CDs that I know, and it sounds very musical. And I'll make a judgment call on the band and how much low end I think I need, and I'll set the high pass filter on the bass bins to that. I don't use subs. My large system is just a big two-way system, a classic studio monitor system, and that's what it sounds like. And I do very little EQ through the rest of the spectrum. The boxes have a 200 hertz bump, so I suck that out a bit, and that's pretty much what I do. And I think the biggest thing I find between empty house and full house is that the one room that I do the most, which is the former blimp hangar over in Port Townsend, empty, it's very lively, and it's hard to get intelligibility. The band comes in and they complain that it just sounds like mush, and you just have to reassure them, just pick a comfortable level, we'll get comfortable there, and it'll all clean up when the place fills up. And generally speaking, they buy that.
So do you have a different set of problems for outdoor or zone enclosures?
Yes.
I think it's easier.
It's easier and it's harder. You don't have the acoustics of a space to deal with. You do have wind noise. You have atmospheric problems like rain to protect yourself and your gear.
The wind blowing your high end away?
Or changing it,
yeah.
Which is sometimes enjoyable. You get kind of a shimmer thing there that's kind of fun sometimes. You have the issue with where you have your speakers relative to your microphones and how much gain before feedback you can have and where is the audience relative to the stage and the speakers and how many speakers you need to have versus how many you have to bring and how early you need to get there and how late you need to stay there, which is always true at a gig. But it's just a different set of problems. And what does the stage sound like? You know, a lot of these, a tent has a sound. It has reflections. It has there's an acoustics of that tent space that's the stage oftentimes. And how do you deal with that? You've got a hard floor, you've got hard walls, you've got a hard ceiling. It's flexible, but it's still hard. It's still a surface, so you have to deal with that. And you can hear it. You go there and do this under it, and you flutter echoes or whatever. So you deal with it.
Mike?
One thing I noticed, I was a little surprised by it, is when I play and we're amplified, we have our own amplifiers, you know, and then as well as the house system, is that many times the musicians I play with tune their amps to the same setting. No matter what the room is, it would seem to me as if you would want to adjust that, particularly EQ or whatever, to try to accommodate what the peculiarities are of the room. And so I've been surprised by that. Have you noticed the musicians you work with who do EQ according to space? Now you might say they're up there, they can't hear what it's like out there, but you do the best you can.
I don't deal with that kind of thing, where musicians are bringing their amps and that's the source of the sound. I take their amps and make them louder to project. It sounds, what you're describing is they're using their amps as their monitors. And, of course, they're going to want it to be the same one to the next because that makes them comfortable. And how it relates to that space versus this space is, you know, that's not their problem. They're concerned about this space, and that's why you have a sound company or a person out there to deal with that. If the musicians here are dealing with here and there, then you lose, you know.
Fine. Situations where I have to mix with a center cluster, which is conveniently located just in front of the stage, but not in front, so that the downward projection is a liability at a certain physical place in the sound field. And
so it's downwardly projecting onto the stage, and that's a problem. Right, but it is.
Yeah, I'll start.
Okay.
I used to do it.
Repeat it. Mixing with a center cluster versus something else.
So I used to do an Easter service at the Opera House downtown, okay? And the speakers were mounted in the proscenium arch, right above the proscenium. And the stage was a thrust stage like this. Mm-hmm. And they put the pulpit off on one side, because there was a Mondo orchestra and a choir and all kinds of stuff. And so the problem was my lectern microphone was literally pointing at one of the clusters. The Opera House had a three-channel system. So we kind of played the game of putting the microphone in the cluster nearest where the microphone was, so you had some sense of direction. And the way that I found to deal with that was to pick a microphone that had really flat off-axis response. So I used a KM84 with a windscreen. And it's, if you look at the curves, it's nice and linear. There's not a lot of hash going on at the high frequencies, and I found I could get a lot of gain before feedback that way.
Yeah, there's really two problems using a center cluster. And the first one is the one that you talked about, which is this lobe coming down from it. And I would solve it the opposite way. I'm a huge fan of small, narrow pattern microphones, and I would do that.
Yeah, well, these are church people, and their concept of where microphones goes varies from somebody who knows exactly where to put the microphone to people whose only concept of mic technique is watching the 6 o'clock news.
Right. So where you don't have any possibility of feedback from the viewer's television to the microphone in the studio.
Yeah.
So the other problem with using a center cluster is I find that it's not a musical listening experience. I had a center cluster at the Backstage nightclub for 9 years or something, and they were going to do all kinds of music, and I had 4 Meyer UPAs to put in there. And rather than split them 2 and 2, on either side, I figured I could get another few dB by, 4 in the center radiating in a thing. And I got my few dB more of power. And the virtue of having a center cluster is that the sound coming from the speakers is in phase everywhere as much as it can be.
It's a single point source.
It's a point source. So the sound is going where it should go. If you've built the center cluster right so that there's not more than one element pointing at the same space, you don't point them all straight ahead. You splay them out so that one speaker is pointing to each part of the room, and you get the most physical coherence possible. You can't get better than that. But I found that you just can't get a musical sound out of it. I find that there is something that you get by having speakers spread out. You get this comb filtering, which is inevitable with with separated speakers. You get this inevitable comb filtering, but I like it. I think it sounds musical and happy. And so a center cluster, even if when you get rid of the lobing problems, and we did it by building a enclosure behind the speaker, so there was really not much coming out of the back. It's still, you can't get it to sound enjoyable. You can get it clear and you can understand what's happening, but it's not musical, in my opinion.
So I think that's, if you're in a situation where you've got speech and music, then it's really a three-channel system's the way to fly.
Yeah, it's great for
speech. If you can do it. Because you can put the speech through the center cluster, and then you still have the left-right spread to do the music through.
So it's the upper.
It's, yeah, depending on your definition of theatrical, but yeah.
Center channel dialogue.
Dialogue, yeah.
That sort of raises the issue I was just going to ask, is articulation of speech versus music, because they have different features that you lock onto with the auditory system.
Mm-hmm.
But you just think, you answered it. The reason I pulled my hand down is you answered it. You said you get great articulation with the center cluster.
Right.
But it doesn't sound musical.
Yeah.
With the side clusters, you lose articulation because of the interference. But with the music, which doesn't have the strong pattern that your picks up, you know, it's going to have a completely different effect. It might sound good. It might not too, but generally it does. And the question I was going to ask, do you find in some situations you have trouble with the time delay, especially when the cluster is way up there? And for people, there be anywhere within the natural field of the speaker?
That's the other negative of a cluster, is that there is often a huge difference in localization for somebody sitting down here, especially. I'm talking here, but my voice is coming from somewhere up there. And musicians don't like that very much. They want the sound to be coming from them. And so having the speakers down here is the preferred way to do, and it's real difficult to have a center cluster down here. So that limits your... I've actually done center clusters behind the performers. I did some shows in the Spanish ballroom in the Olympic Hotel, and they were on the long wall, and there's no place to hang anything in there and no place to set anything. So I had my JBL 4550s, which are a horn-loaded double 15, so they're about the size of a refrigerator on its side, and I stacked them on top of each other. How can I show this to you? So that one of them is pointing this way and one of them is pointing that way, and I carefully figured out where, and those were going up to about 500 that I had in those days. And then there were some 2440 horns on top with the 90 degree radials on top that I just pointed over the top. And together that was about 6 feet tall. And then these radials were on top of that. And I had Riley and Maloney, which was a acoustic folk duo with two vocals and two guitars, standing in front of that. And I mean, there's a limit to how loud you can get it. But I could get it loud enough because they were pretty directional and big speakers. And I wish I had pictures of that, because it was, you wouldn't think that it would be the right thing to do.
Did they like the monitors?
Yeah, that was their monitors, essentially.
Yeah.
Yeah, they thought it was okay. I only did it once or a couple times.
Occasionally, we would do shows at the center at the mural by putting a stack of speakers center of the mural back against it and just use it as a reflecting plane.
Really?
Yeah.
So it was like a parabolic?
Yeah.
Cool. Steve?
Is live sound typically mono?
Not for me.
Why don't you talk about that and then I'll take a different position.
I'm a strong proponent of stereo. And even if my stereo is mono vocals right down the center, but the bands spread around. I prefer that. I like the concept that I have space in my mix. I don't have all the instruments competing with the vocals for space in the center. And all my verbs and stuff and the things like that are stereo, and it keeps, when you run the verbs in stereo, it keeps them from clouding the center mix. So I prefer it. Even if I'm forced to mix the band in mono and just have the verbs in stereo, I still think that's a better scene.
I agree with that last part, absolutely. The first part, though, the thing that keeps me from ever wanting to mix in extreme stereo, I've had people come and use my rig, and I should explain that I'm often not the mixer. I am the gear provider, the system provider, and I make sure that it works. And then the band has their own operator, and they do whatever it is they do, and I shut up about whether I think it's a good idea or not. And I've seen a lot of times where they will have like a six-piece vocal group lined up like this, and the operator will have the pans set very carefully for that each person so that they are panned to their relative position on the stage. And that makes total sense if you're in TJ's position right there. But for everybody else on either side, they're going to get a completely wacko mix. So this person over here is going to get everybody who's on this side of the stage like crazy, and they're not going to hear the people on that side of the stage at all. And they're going to come to you and complain that, why can't I hear my brother-in-law, Joey, down at the end there, like I can hear my hated cousin, Jim, on this end? And it's because there's no way to do that unless you have another outboard PA, outboard of your main PA. So you've got a left and a right, but you've got a right and a left further out so that these people in the on the extremes are actually hearing a stereo image. The rest of the time, so I agree completely with Rick about the reverb returns being in stereo and most of the band being in mono, with the exception of stereo keyboards. You should pan those out because that's stereo keyboard is kind of a that, and you hear it, and you get the effect. Well, depending on the patch, you get the effect, but you don't have 20 different keyboards that are each lined up like that. You're getting something.
Right. I don't do that. I restrict the left-right separation.
Yeah.
So.
Some people don't, and it drives me crazy.
Yeah. Way back in the 50s, somebody tried this at the Newport Jazz Festival. Mm-hmm. And they used, I think the number was 6 dB of separation. And it was enough to get a sense of stereo across the field, mm-hmm. and not enough to cause trouble with people hearing a weird mix that we were sitting on the edges.
Where's that on a pan pot? Where's 6 dB? It's not all the way.
No.
If this probably, is center, it's what, like that? Maybe?
Probably 10 o'clock, my guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. But the other way to do it is in your post-processing to create a cross path so that you can feed it full separation and the post-processing turns it into 6 dB stereo.
Define what you mean by post-processing. I don't know what that means.
Whatever the processing is you have after the front of house console. So for me it's a SIMnet 8x8.
It's a what?
A SIMnet 8x8.
Oh. So there's something inside it that's taking left and right and making it so it's less left and right?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't do that.
On some boards you can do that just by sending left and right to 2 cents and mixing them back for another 2 cents and just setting the tech.
Right. Yeah, on the Yamahas I did it on the Matrix.
You can just do it right on the board.
If you guys are having a hard time hearing, you should move closer. That depends on how diligent the person with the band is about checking to see your left and right separation. Often people will pan something left and go to listen to the right and see what's coming out of there, which is what they should be doing. And if you've done a trick to it, you're going to be spoken to.
Well, I smile sometimes. It's been 20 years.
Well, you're not a PA provider either. So.
Not anymore.
Okay, Bob.
Yeah, let's move on to another topic. Snakes. I have struggled with snakes. They have bad channels. They're heavy. They're not long enough. They have the wrong connectors. I don't like snakes. And I'm intrigued by the evolution. There seems to be a new movement toward digital snakes. You know, one Cat 5 cable, you put whatever head you want on it. Would you trust something like that? Is that too much technology?
I don't know, so I never used one.
I can talk about that. I work on big live broadcasts. We use tons and tons of modes. It's called DT12. It's 12. And we don't run single lines. We just don't in that environment. But the rule of thumb, I mean, I'm more on the video side than the other side, is that you're going to have bad pairs. In other words, when I run the video lines, if I run a 10, if the client requests 20 lines, 12 lines, I'm going to run 20. And it's the same on the audio side. You're going to have bad pairs in those modes, and it's just a fact of life. So you always build headroom, significant headroom, when you run the snakes, so that if you have the bad pair, you just go to another one. And that's how that works, headroom.
Okay, so let me ask you the same question, though. Would you trust a digital snake? I mean, it's very enticing in many ways.
I haven't seen anything like that. We're using, again, it's called DT12. I don't know where the name comes from. Maybe someone here does.
The digital snakes that I've seen are connected to a digital console. The standalone digital snake that was, I read about 20 years ago, I never saw any, I never see any.
Yeah, they were always way more money than a hunk of wire.
Yeah. And even copper is so expensive now, but I don't know that there's freestanding digital snakes get to use with the
Roland has them. Roland, I believe, has them.
I think Whirlwind has something. Oh.
When you say digital snake, is that what type of cable is it? Is that Cat 5 or is it?
Typically Cat 5.
Usually, yeah.
Or 6E.
Or fiber in some cases, yeah.
Yeah.
So the deal is the audio gets shoved into a mic preamp, and then it gets digitized.
Right.
And it gets multiplexed and shoved down the snake, and then we undo that at the other end. And I think my problem with that is if I'm running a digital console, I really don't want to force the audio through another stage of conversion. So I don't want to go back to the analog domain once I've gone digital. So the best thing is where the console's mic preamps pull out from the body. You put those on stage, and you tie that back to the board with a couple of Cat 5s. That's pretty good.
Yeah, the problem with digital snake and digital consoles is that in my world, you have a front-of-house console and you have a monitor console that are two separate consoles, two separate operators. They're doing their thing. The digital snake has one set of preamps, and who's controlling that?
Well, there's a way around that.
But nobody seems to have implemented it.
Everybody that I've been working with on projects like that has considered it and is working on it. So the game is that you have analog gain trim that's on the mic preamp, and then after the conversion, you have some amount of digital gain trim that allows you to push the level up and down as you need it on your console.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what they're doing. There's always, but anytime you have the shared mic preamp, it's who owns the gain trim.
Right.
So one of the companies did a thing where the analog gain trim was digitally controlled, and if the front of house guy ran the analog gain trim down, say 6 dB,
mm-hmm.
then the digital gain trim would go up 6 dB.
Right.
And then that way it'd be transparent to everyone.
Yeah, but it's not, I'm told that it's not implemented. I can't buy that as a feature in a console that I would get, in two consoles that I would get.
Okay.
I'm told that. I don't know.
Okay.
I don't own any of those. And to get back to the question of what do you do with the snake with the channels that don't work, you fix them. I don't have any snakes that have channels that don't work.
So my other problem with digital snakes is the concept of direction. That the cable, once you do that, the cables implicitly got a direction from stage box to console and doesn't often have return lines or things like that where I need to get a signal back to the stage. So now what do? I run another analog snake alongside it. So just give me my 27 pairs of copper going back and forth because they have no sense of direction. They don't care whether I drive them from the console and take them back here or whether I drive them from here and take them there.
The only digital systems that I've looked at in any detail, and this is just me, is the Soundcraft one. And they've got a stage box that has the inputs and the outputs,
oh, right,
as well as a local box that, at the console that has inputs and outputs, so you
yeah.
can insert things.
That's pretty well thought out.
Yeah, except you can't have another console over there and deal with the trim. You got to have two of these stupid boxes with the wire, I think.
It depends on which way you set the switch, whether you have a main or aux or redundant. What console?
Do they have two at Benaroya? Do they have an onstage?
Yeah.
Digital?
And
how do they do it?
They have a house controller and an onstage controller, and you have to just set it over to the position where you have a house and a monitor, and then one of those will take, I forget which ones takes control of the trim, but only one console can control the trim.
Yeah, so the other one gets reduced gain when the other one turns it down or up.
Right.
They don't do the complementary digital thing?
Then you can make it up digitally.
Yeah, but you've got to consciously. It doesn't automatically do it, does it?
Yeah, and they talk on the headset. They talk on the headset. Hey,
well,
I'm glad I'm going to screw you up here. I'm going to get you down. You'll just fix it at
your end.
Okay. That's not quite automatic.
Next. All right, cool. Thank you. Wireless. We've gone through this huge white space thing recently. Do you guys have any? I recently used a 700 megahertz system in a show that I worked on, and it worked great. How much of that is what's the word? You know,
smoke and mirrors.
Smoke and mirrors, and I mean, I know it's against the law, but it still works.
I've had smarter people than me tell me that if you used a 700 megahertz system and above in here, nobody would ever know out there. Mm-hmm. The problem is going to be that the reason we lost 700 is because it got sold to the makers of these future devices that will use that bandwidth. And those devices don't yet exist, but when they do, they're going to be all over that place. And if you've got your wireless microphones in the 700 and over bandwidth, you're going to get all kinds of junk on your wireless signal. And that's why you shouldn't use it. You should forget about the idea of I can get away with breaking the law, but you're going to be stomped on when Jesus Christ Superstar is doing his solo quiet thing and somebody's phone rings and gets a signal, and you're going to not like that at all.
Think about the relative power, because the wireless mics are limited to 100 milliwatts by FCC Part 15. And the guys that are using the spectrum for communication, like to a cell phone or maybe for broadband wireless or Wi-Fi, they don't have that limit. So let's say they're 100 watts against your 100 milliwatts. Who's going to win?
Right. I mean, what wireless system do you use typically, or what do you like these days?
I use the ones that I have, and I happen to have some Audio-Technicas, and I have some Shures, and I have some AKGs. And the thing that is absolutely vexing to me is that I have spent, I don't buy the top of the line ones because I can't afford it like Rick does, but
I don't anymore. I can't afford it either.
Did yours all, were those all 700s?
Yeah.
UHFR?
Yeah.
Holy crap.
Yeah, I got tubed.
Did you didn't swap them in?
I swapped two of them.
Good.
I couldn't afford to do any more, and
wasn't
getting enough rental business, so it wasn't worth owning more than two channels.
Well, anyway, what cheeses me is that I set up mine, and I have to very carefully set them up and point the antennas and get the frequencies all set up so that they work fine. And I still get occasionally problems, sometimes worse than others. Somebody walks in, some musician walks in with one of these Shure plastic guys with the little antennas and sets it up wherever, and they walk 2 miles away and it still works fine. And they wander all around the room and they have this beat up transmitter and it works great. What's going on there? I don't get it. So I'm not saying buy the cheapest ones you can get, but it's always amazed me that those things work as well as they do. So that was probably a less helpful comment about how to do live sound.
Okay. Anybody out there have any experiences recently with wireless?
I hate them.
A cable is more reliable than a wireless.
Yeah, give me this any day of the week.
Yeah.
And it's funny, you know, if you're doing you know, like spoken word or voice or something like that, and they go, I want a lapel mic.
Oh
yeah, sure, I got lapel mics. No, what they didn't say is it's wireless. Today the default, the term lapel mic is defined as a lavalier mic that is wireless. You show up with a wired lavalier, and they're going to, huh? What? Yeah. Well, no. I can't deal with this.
Yeah. Well, when I used to work at the news, you know, like news magazine shows, 60 Minutes. 20 years ago, if you were recording sound for a network newscast, even if the guy is over there, they wanted you to use wireless.
Yeah.
In photojournalism,
yeah.
You want the subject to forget that he's on camera and forget that you're there.
Okay.
Yeah, a really good example of that also is the guitarist who wants a wireless in their stand, and Mike never leaves the stand, but they want a wireless. What the hell? Why do you need a wireless? It's not going anywhere.
The Diane Sawyers, I mean, they don't want to lie. Forget it.
Yeah.
Not gonna happen.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, and they want to be able to walk off the set and not have to worry about tripping on the cable.
Well, I'm talking about the field.
Okay.
Not on the set.
Right.
It's hard. Yeah. In the field, when you're doing field recording, these people don't want to be tethered, and the producers don't want you to tether non-professional talent.
Right.
Unless you're recording, you're doing an interview of the guy who just got killed in Iraq. You know, if he's got all these mic stands, you know, and mic cables, it's just...
Right.
So I guess belaboring the point.
The thing about wireless that's confusing to me is I'm not convinced that the seizure of frequencies is over. They've guaranteed some frequencies for us type of user, but there's a lot of other frequencies that get used, and I'm not convinced that those are going to be stable for a while. So if you don't have to buy wireless, I would advise not buying it for a while until all of that nails down. And other people know more than me.
I talked to a guy recently who's going into a field called Wi-Fi.
Wi-Fi?
Wi-Fi, because it's white spaces. Wi-Fi over white spaces. And one of the things that he was dealing with was having a database, a centralized database, that when the receiver... part of its handshaking situation is it looks up a geolocation database of what.
That's still theoretical at this point, though.
Yeah, right. But that's why he wants to get into the business, because he wants to bring it up. Like Google has it, Microsoft has it, and they're trying to work with it. But it was very interesting that they have sensors locally that say what frequencies are already used in a given space. And so part of the handshake is these are free areas. And we'll spread spectrum to these areas.
So there's a new, recently written epilogue to the White Spaces thing on the Shure website. And Mark Frink in Live Sound Magazine had a good column this month. I recommend you read it. Mm-hmm. But the database thing, that's going to happen. We don't have the White Space data communications devices yet. And every major market is supposed to be guaranteed 2 TV channels. And how many
TV
wireless
range channels? TV range channels, not
analog TV channels.
6 megahertz hunks of the spectrum.
Yeah.
Okay. And I don't know how many wirelesses you can put into that. It depends a lot on the receiver technology. That's one of the things you get when you spend more money is better receivers. So the licensed users will submit, will get their licenses, and they'll submit their times of usages to the FCC, and that will become part of the database. And then, in theory, the White Spaces devices will look at the database before they go live to determine whether or not they have a particular frequency. That's the theory.
How wide is this band that the sensors are looking at? Because the wider the band, the more costly the device is to scan that frequency range?
I don't know.
It'll be interesting to see where all this goes. So it's 9:45. Do we want to take a 10-minute break?
We got to do drawings for prizes.
We got to do our drawings. Yeah. We got some waters and some coffee.
Are you guys thirsty? You want to take a break, or do you want to keep slogging on to get over with earlier?
Drawings.
Let's take a vote.
Coffee. Coffee. Okay, let's do 10 minutes for real, not the usual 20-minute 10 minutes.
And we'll do the drawing at the end of that.
Thank you. just the journal entries are like the first seven. The journals themselves were the first seven. It's then there's all preprints and conference notes.
Right. Okay. Okay. If you need more, you know where they are.
Right. I think that'll be a great big drink. Thank you.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes.
You thought the Frank Lyko Award ceremony was exciting?
Oh, we got to do the...
We got our door prizes now.
Okay, door prizes.
Yeah, boy, we got enough for almost everybody, huh? Okay, where's the guy with the whistle? Man, that was a loud one. So we got a bunch of CDs. Loopology.